This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you wonder why animals do some of the crazy things they do, give us a call right now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. A little later on this hour, we'll be discussing another issue in the animal kingdom. And what will it be today, Patricia?
Well, you know, even though dogs and wolves are biologically the same species, today we're going to talk about why creating wolf-dog hybrids might not be such a good idea.
And we'll also welcome author John Grogan to the program to tell us about his now-famous dog, Marley, and how it continues to impact his life even today. Plus, a little later, we'll hear one last poem from cowboy poet Baxter Black in honor of National Poetry Month. That's all coming up, but first let's take some calls at 1-800-462-7413. Here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Chris. I'm calling from Azle, Texas, and I have some questions about my new dog.
Well, go right ahead, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. She's a lab mix. She's pretty big. I didn't know I was in the market for a big dog, but when she saw me, she said, "Thank goodness I found you."
So
we adopted her. She's a great dog. She shows great potential. She's about 2 years old. The only thing that I am having real serious problems with is she likes to paw, and she's rather large. She's about 55 pounds right now, and it kind of knocks my kids for a loop when she, you know, goes to do the paw with them. So I'm trying to figure out how to keep her from pawing.
That is such an interesting issue, because there are dogs who just come out of the chute wanting to use their paws to get what they want or solve problems, and there are other dogs who just don't. It's highly variable. There are some breed-related predispositions.
Yeah.
Boxers, Larry. Boxers are all about their paws. I mean, they practically have prehensile thumbs. You know, boxers are always using their feet to solve some kind of problem. There's a reason they call them boxers.
Yeah, I was going to say.
They play with their paws. I mean, really, it's amazing. But there are other groups of dogs that people talk about, the Great Pyrenees paw, the peer paw, they call it. They'll slap a big white paw on your lap. They'll pet me, pet me. So let me ask you about your lab cross. Is the paw about, I want attention, I want petting, or is it, when does it happen?
She wants my attention constantly. The minute, she wants to be this close to my face, just inches away. But mostly when I'm sitting down or she's trying to get attention that way, she's just constantly putting her foot up. Even when you're sitting right next to her and she wants to, of course, crawl into your lap.
And crawl down your throat.
Exactly. I'm like, you are way too big to be a lap dog.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of these needy dogs, and you know, they don't necessarily have to have had a tough beginning. Some of the puppies who had perfect, wonderful homes, you know, perfect beginnings, they're just like that. They're just, I just want. Mm-hmm. I want attention. I want to play. So there are a couple things I do. One is, and this is pretty obvious, but I need to say it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
A dog of this age, of that breeding, exercise, 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 exercise. There's just nothing like a tired dog.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
be
that's
a runner.
Obviously going to help you tremendously. I would teach her enough. And enough means enough.
Enough means enough.
That's pretty clear. And it's not that hard to do. You say enough in a low voice. You pat her head, pop, pop on top of her head.
Ooh.
It's not like a slap. It's just like,
no.
Pat, pat. We tend to do that to dogs all the time. They don't like it any more than our kids do. And very often when you go pat, pat, your dog will honestly just go away, especially if you fold your arms and look away. So you say enough, pat, pat, fold your arms, look away. Very often she'll actually go away and do something else. If not, you stand up, sort of body block her like a soccer goalie, you know, away from your chair or your couch, and then sit back down. When she's not bothering you, like the microsecond she's not looking at you with her paw in your lap, give her something to chew on. But teach her that there are times that I'm going to pet you, there are other times I'm not. And here's one more thing that you might want to try. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. They give you your paw, their paw, you know, flap that big paw in your lap.
Mm-hmm.
You take it gently in your hand, and then you don't let go. So they're like, oh, here's my paw. Hey, you, yo, pet me, pet me. And you take their paw, and they'll sit there, and after about 30 seconds, they'll start pulling it back. Don't squeeze, just don't let go. And don't look at her, don't interact with her. It's just like, you're going to give me your paw, I'm going to keep it. And it's sort of slow, but usually after about 2-3 weeks, a lot of dogs, I'm not giving her my paw. Every time I give it to her, she keeps it. Now, the big exception is golden retrievers. They would be happy to have you take their paw in your hand for 7 hours. So I don't, you know, who knows what else is in your lab, Cross, but those are some ideas. Take them and run, and good luck.
And thank you very much for calling, Christine. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, we received a very intriguing email question from an Alaska listener named Jen, and here's what she writes. I often wonder what aesthetic sensibilities my dog has. For example, when I'm caught up in the splendor of a beautiful sunset on the beach, does my dog perceive anything beautiful about that? Or when I listen to music in the car, is there any possibility the dog likes it? Or is she suffering silently, thinking the noise is too loud and unpleasant?
Oh, it's such a good question. And, you know, we just don't know enough yet about the brain of a dog to understand how they might be responding. But one of the things we do know, if you look at the different senses that you mentioned visual senses. You know, do dogs have a kind of a visual aesthetic? Well, you know, we really don't know. There's a YouTube going around all over everywhere, by the way, of an elephant in India who paints pictures of elephants. And one of them is actually carrying a flower in its trunk. And when the elephant started painting the flower, I was like, oh, I don't know. Would an elephant really paint a flower? But so here's the question. Is that elephant really getting that he or she is painting an elephant? And is there a way that makes the painting satisfying? There's some evidence in chimpanzees who do some painting that there's some individual chimps who will paint and then basically be given another paintbrush with another color, and they're like, no, it's done. No, I'm done. They'll actually sit back, Larry, and look at it like, So now that's a primate. That's a higher primate. That's an ape. So do dogs have a visual aesthetic sense? I don't know. If they were going to have an aesthetic sense, I would say it would be sound. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's sounds that are pleasant to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they probably have a chemical. You know, if anything, I would imagine that they're perceiving the smells coming in on the wind like we would listen to a symphony or something.
You know, when I think about a sunset and watching a sunset, you're sitting there. It's typically calm. Your dog is sitting next to you. It may be the sunset, or it may be just the stillness and the calmness of the human.
That's a really, really good point. I think that's a great point. And it makes me think of the times that I sit up on the hill behind my farmhouse watching the sunset. But you know what's happening? My dog is sitting beside me, but his nose is going. You know, that little nose twitching back and forth, you know.
Uh-huh.
So is he smelling while I'm looking? I don't know. But I love your stillness comment. I think dogs would love it if we would just calm down more.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we've got some more callers online, and maybe we should go back to the phones. By the way, if you'd like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And here is our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Heather from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Heather, pleasure to talk with you. What's on your mind?
I've got a 14-year-old lab named Kai Dog, and he is in great shape for his age. He still is loving life very much. My question for you is about his night gallops. He's having really intense dreaming. Like, when he was a puppy, he used to do this, but it would only last for maybe 30 seconds, and then he would stop. And I could always sort of say his name, and he would come out of it. Now, I don't know if it's because he's partially deaf and he can't hear me or if he's just really into this dream, but sometimes his dreams are so violent that it's like he's kicking the walls and my neighbors can hear it. So it's really, really crazy, and I don't know what to do. I've gone to my vet, and she suggested sleeping pills for him. I don't know if I like that idea. And then she said, well, you could use the sleeping pills. So I'm just curious as to what you think might be going on and how we might be able to remedy, because I feel bad when he doesn't get to sleep, because I also don't get to sleep.
Right.
I want to see the face on her neighbor when she says, the banging on the wall is my dog dreaming.
It is.
You're right. Yeah, sure. Sure it is.
What the heck's going on at Heather's?
You know, boy, what an interesting conundrum, isn't it? You know, there's a little bit of research out there on dogs and dreaming, and we know they have REM sleep like we do. It appears that they dream very much like we do. I actually had an older dog, Pippi Tay, who died a month shy of 16, and in her last year of life, her dreams also became more and more, the motor activity, the little paw twitching, mm-hmm. became thrashing. And she actually started whimpering as if she was scared. And I started waking her up because I just seemed like she was having nightmares to me. So I started waking her up. I'm not a veterinarian, so medications are certainly something you should talk to your veterinarian about. Just personally, I also share your sort of lack of interest in using some kind of a sleeping pill or medication on an older dog, you know?
Yeah.
What I would do, I think you're right about the sound, is that your dog's just going deaf. I mean, 14 is very typical.
Yeah.
Is just put a hand on him and just wake him up gently. Now, that means that you've woken up as well.
Yeah.
The other thing, and this is, you know, again, out of my field, but just personally, I can tell you that I have had some luck with Chinese medicine, with board-certified veterinarians, DVMs, who then went on to specialize in Chinese medicine, which is the kind of expertise that I'm comfortable using. I have had some luck with Chinese herbs helping affect dogs who are fearful, dogs who are anxious.
Oh.
So you might want to think about, is there anybody in your area who is truly trained, who doesn't dabble in this, but is, you know, truly trained in that kind of medicine? Because it tends to treat medical issues with a very different perspective. So it's just something to think about.
Something to think about. And good luck, Heather.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Coming up next, we'll discuss wolf-dog hybrids. What can we expect from them, and should you ever consider having one as a pet? We'll hear what Patricia has to say right after this. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. And Tricia, there's a controversy here in Wisconsin right now about how wolves should be managed in the wild. And it got me wondering how you felt about wolf-dog hybrids.
Well, you know, I have a problem with wolf-dog hybrids, and I know that's very controversial. But
yeah. The
fact is hybridizing wolves and dogs, it results in animals, because of this hybridization, it results in animals who are highly variable. You sort of never know what you're going to get. You know, are you going to get an individual who acts like a wolf, one who acts like a dog? Most importantly, some of them act like neither, and some of them are more aggressive than either a wolf or a dog.
No.
So I don't want to say this is true of all of them. Some wolf-dog hybrids are wonderful animals. Wolf dogs, the fanciers call them. They're gentle, they're benign, and they really do seem happy living with humans. But you know, there's a but coming.
Yeah, but sure.
But you know, even though wolves are the same species as dogs, that's why they hybridize so easily. Wolves behave so differently than dogs. There's a reason you don't see wolves in dog training classes. Wolves tend to be much more afraid of unfamiliar things, which can be very problematic if you're living with them. They're much more destructive of property. I work with one who literally chewed his way through an apartment by the time he was 4 months old and was working on my arm while I was doing the intake. They're much more likely to be aggressive to unfamiliar dogs. That's just part of living in the wild. And not surprisingly, wolves are intensely predatory, which is why some of them can be very dangerous around young children.
So wolf-dog hybrids can cause some problems for the people who own them, but I'm wondering, what about the animals themselves?
Well, yeah, you know, that's one of my biggest concerns. Is you look at how wolves evolve. They evolve to roam through these huge territories, hundreds of miles, and it's just really difficult for me to imagine a wolf being happy confined to somebody's backyard. And by the way, good luck confining them. That's another thing about wolves compared to dogs. But, you know, if you think about a wolf, they are amazing individuals. They're so smart. They're free-thinking. They're independent. They're very self-possessed. Why take that away?
Yeah.
You know, why take that away? The wolves who are adapted to live happily in human society and accept our rules and our culture are called
Dogs.
That's right.
So what does it mean for the wolf population when we start creating wolf-dog hybrids?
Well, you know, that's a big concern of a lot of biologists. It doesn't necessarily do any good. As a matter of fact, it can do a lot of harm to populations of wild wolves if there are wolf-dog hybrids out there. Hybrids, if they get loose, and they do, are much more likely to kill livestock. You know, they're not as afraid of people and buildings, and so they're more likely to kill livestock, threaten domestic animals, simply because they're less fearful. A lot of the reports of attacks on humans by wolves in Europe actually are believed to be caused by wolf-dog hybrids. So my bottom line is that if we love wolves, shouldn't we be working on preserving their territories in the wild and just letting them stay wild?
I'm all for that. I agree with you.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah. Thanks for talking with us about that. And by the way, Patricia, you recently visited a wolf park. And if listeners want to see a photograph from your visit, how would they do that?
Oh, just check it out at callingallpets.org. There's a photograph of me and a wonderful wolf named Ayla. She lives at an educational facility, Wolf Park in Indiana. It's a great photograph. I look domestic. She looks wild.
Okay. And if you'd like to join in with a question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And we have someone online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Pete from River Falls.
River Falls, Wisconsin. Pete, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got a very sweet, but what we've always referred to as very neurotic, chocolate lab golden retriever mix. It's a female. Her name is Emmy. She's 10 years old. Some of the behaviors include she won't go through doors unless they're wide open. If you rattle the leash, time to go for a walk. Come on, Emmy, let's go for a walk. She hides under the table, even though she loves to go for walks. If a dry leaf gets blown across the asphalt road, that sound sometimes just freaks her out, where she almost pulls your arm off. And for a while, she wouldn't go downstairs, and then suddenly she started to go downstairs again. But those are some examples of what we consider her kind of neurotic behaviors, and
yeah.
Just wondering what you thought.
Yeah, it does sound like she's got a lot of angst
in
her life. There are a couple of general things that I'll suggest before I get specific. One is, believe it or not, you might want to think about her diet. Believe it or not.
Really?
There are some foods that are really hot and seem to bring out reactivity in some dogs. You also might want to think about that plug-in dog appeasing pheromone, which seems to calm some individuals. It's not magic, but it's just so wonderful in that you spend whatever it is, $30 or something, and you plug it into the wall, and there's your behavior modification program. You know?
Really? Like aromatherapy for dogs?
Except it's based on a pheromone that is actually produced by the glands beside the milk glands of a lactating mother. And so the belief is that it tends to calm individuals just as puppies are calmed when they're actually nursing from their mother.
Mm-hmm.
Other thing to do is to try and figure out what are the triggers and then see if you could classically counter-condition her. So like the leash thing. Now, isn't this interesting? Here's this dog who, once she's outside, loves to be outside, right?
But then hides under the table.
So there's some trigger. And it might be going through doors. I mean, if she's afraid of doors, maybe it's about doors. So what I would do with dogs who are that way with doors, and I had one like this once, by the way, Tulip, my huge Great Pyrenees, who was the bravest, most wonderful dog. She protected my lambs from coyotes. She was a very brave dog. She was terrified of a cardboard box in the living room when she was 5 months old. So what I did with her is I put a leash on her. I got her the best food in the world that she absolutely loved. And then we started sort of going in circles about 5 feet away from the door. And we just started going in little circles. So I just walked in a circle, gave her a treat. Walked in a circle, gave her a treat. And I started circling my way towards the door. And at the first session, I never even opened the door.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a door you can leave open, that's even better. Basically, on session two, you're going to circle your way such that you circle her so that 2 inches of the circle passes through the doorway. But mostly what she's focused on is going in this circle and getting a treat from you. And then gradually, you get the idea here, mm-hmm. you're going to start circling in the middle of the doorway and then circling your way all the way outside and then coming right back in. And what happens is they just start forgetting about the doorway thing. And it took me about
7 years?
Yeah, right. Right. No. Yeah, how long do you have?
I don't think we have that much time.
No,
left.
It took about 3 weeks.
3 weeks? Mm-hmm.
But she was young, so it might take you a little longer. The trick with this is to be really patient.
Okay.
So give that a try, and then think of other situations that you can do the same kind of procedure on.
Well, hey, thank you very much.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-462-7413, and let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Chris from Milwaukee.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 3-year-old border collie named Skye, and she's a very well-behaved dog, except for one particular thing.
There's always one thing, isn't there? It's always one.
Yeah. When I take her out to the dog park, she tends to start acting like a border collie. She will, when she's far away from me, when she sees another dog, she will crouch, give the dog the border collie stare, then she'll run up right at it. And depending on what the other dog does, she'll either stop right in front of it, give it a chest thump, or she'll bowl the other dog over.
Ooh.
Ooh.
The schoolyard bully.
Yeah. She tends to be...
That's a little harsh, but, you know, that's so interesting with these herding dogs. They do tend to like to use their skills. But, you know, what she's doing is actually the border collie eye and the stalking posture, yes. But running straight at him and sort of bowling him over, mm-mm.
That's not what a border collie
does. No, what she should be doing is doing big outruns around them. You know, somebody else is playing ball with their dog. You see this a lot with border collies. My Lassie, 14 years old, when I'm playing ball with my younger border collie, Lassie will do big outruns around him. So, you know, he's running and she's like, I'm going to get to the front. I'm going to stop his forward motion.
Oh, she does that a lot, too.
Okay. But the running straight at, chest bumping, that's just rude.
Yeah.
So here's the good news. You have a border collie. And if there's any dog who you can teach a flying lie down to, it's a border collie. Or whatever you want to do. What I would start out of that context, don't start at the dog park, in your yard, somewhere you have some room. I would just basically, I think a lie down is the best thing to do. Border collies are really easy to get to lie down. So teach her a flying lie down in that it's not just that she's sitting beside you and you say lie down, she lies down. Set up situations where you're walking together. Let her get 2 feet ahead of you and then say, lie down. Good girl. Treat, throw ball, whatever makes her really, really happy. Oh, this is the most fun game ever in the world. And basically you want to work your way up to her lying down when she's running away from you, because that's the context you have to work on it. If you just expect a lie down to work when they're running away from you when you've never worked on it in that context,
no,
it's not going to happen. But so start where she's right beside you, then she's moving ahead of you slowly, and then gradually the two things you need to manage are how far away is she, and two, how fast is she going. So work on those two things separately. And if you can't get that, I don't know that I'd take her to the dog park.
Yeah.
I'm really, because I'm not sure that's such a good habit for her to be in.
So good luck, Chris.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
Oh, buy sheep. I forgot. Buy sheep.
Buy some sheep. Patricia, a listener named Kay has a question for you about chicken behavior. We don't often get this. She says she's aware that chickens establish pecking orders, and her flock certainly fits the mold. She has 3 roosters and 7 hens. And everyone seems to know their status in comparison to the others. But Kay notices that when one chicken becomes ill or injured, the rest of the chickens seem to gather around it and bother it. Some of the birds will attack and chase the sick bird, while others seem to be concerned as if they're trying to help or protect the sick bird. And sometimes those who appear to be protecting the sick bird might add an occasional peck for good measure. Kay wants to know, why does this behavior occur, and is it common among non-captive bird flocks?
Well, it's certainly common. I can start with captive bird flocks. It's very common. It's a big problem with producers. It's very, very common. And the speculation, the hypotheses range from, particularly if an animal is injured, that chickens have evolved to use their beaks to investigate. You know, they're omnivores. They eat pretty much everything out in the wild. And so, you know, people have chickens know anything sort of shiny, anything different, they peck at. So one individual will peck at the sort of strange behaving or looking thing, and then another one does. And there's something called emotional contagion, where one individual starts and everybody picks it up, and then it becomes a self-feeding kind of a process, sort of a feeding frenzy, except it's a pecking frenzy. So it's very, very common. It's actually why the big flocks, the commercial producers, actually de-beak the individuals. That's a big welfare issue right there. So one, it's common. What's not so common is the comment about others protecting. That's where my ears pricked up. That's really interesting. I have not heard a lot of examples of that. So I suspect in the wild it's much less common, although I wouldn't at all be surprised. You know, these social groupings, whether it's wolf packs or chickens, you do see one individual who's basically either killed or drummed out of the pack because they're different or they're ill.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon at all. So it probably happens in the wild, but just less because individuals can escape if they're not captive.
Yeah. And if someone else has a question for us, what do they do?
Oh, well, we love it when you send us questions or answers.
We love
your answers especially. So you might want to make a comment about if you've seen something like this in your chickens, if you have chickens. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join in with a question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, a conversation with Marley and Me author John Grogan. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome John Grogan to the show. John is a journalist and author of the best-selling book Marley and Me, Life and Love with the World's Worst Dog, which is now out in paperback. John, welcome to the program. For those who haven't read your book yet, tell us about the main character, Marley.
Well, Marley was a character. Jenny and I, my wife, we were newlyweds. We were just starting out in our marriage together. We bought this little tiny bungalow down on the water in South Florida, got it all fixed up, and then we had the bright idea to bring home a puppy. And that puppy was Marley. And if you have a copy of the book, that's really him on the cover, an adorable little Labrador Retriever puppy who quickly grew into a 100-pound steamroller of total unbridled energy. The veterinarian, you know, after about 3 visits with him, he looked up and he said, you know, if this dog were a child, he'd be on Ritalin right now. Yeah, you know, I mean, Marley had a beautiful soul. He was just full of joy and happiness, and he had the best intentions. He just wanted to be our best friend and do everything right. But, you know, he had way more energy than his little brain could handle. So everything he tried, it was comical. You know, every day there was another antic or misdeed, and, you know, he'd jump right through the screen door day after day, and he'd dig through the drywall. He went right through the kitchen floor one day. And so that was life with Marley.
You say that you got a dog as practice before having kids. I thought that was kind of interesting. How did your relationship with Marley ultimately influence the way you approach parenthood?
Well, you know, it was kind of a half joke that we were practicing parenthood with Marley, but, you know, we were young. We were, you know, 20-somethings. So we'd never had any real responsibilities before. We had dogs growing up, and they were great, but, you know, really it was our parents doing most of the work. So, you know, Marley really did teach us a lot of skills that come in handy for parents. I mean, I think the first one was patience and really to find that way to, you know, for someone you love, whether it's a dog or a child or any relative, to love them for what they are, flaws and all. And, you know, Marley taught us that. You know, he really pushed us to the edge on many occasions. But we loved that dog, and we really came to realize that that's an important truth, that, you know, love is really about being unconditional and accepting others for what they are. And Marley taught us those lessons.
Can you think of any stories, I'll bet you can, about Marley that didn't make it into the book?
Well, yeah, there are many. I like to say that every day was an adventure with this dog. Most of the best stories are in there, but there were some that we pulled out to keep the book at a reasonable length. You know, one story that I liked was we bought this little bungalow, and the previous owner was a serious gardener, and he had these beautiful hibiscus shrubs with the big dinner-sized plate flowers, you know, and that was a really healthy plant. And then after we got Marley, it started having this mysterious ailment. the buds would start swelling, and they looked beautifully healthy, but just like the day before they would blossom, they would disappear overnight. And I was convinced it was some blight or virus, and I was calling the plant experts and the garden centers, and we're all scratching our heads. And then one morning, I look outside, and there's Marley. He apparently had a thing for these hibiscus flowers, which are edible, and he'd be jumping up as high as he could go and snatching a flower and jumping down with it, and so, like, my bushes were bare of flowers until about the 6-foot height, and then there were flowers on top. That was a pretty typical Marley moment.
Oh, man. You mentioned that you were inspired to write the book after 800 people responded to your column about Marley's death. What kind of response did you expect to get when you wrote Marley and Me?
Well, actually, a kind of a muted one, really. I mean, it's a highly personal story. I started out writing what I thought was going to be this book about this funny dog. But really, by the first couple of pages into the first chapter, I realized I couldn't tell his story without telling the story of my wife and me and our relationship as a newlywed couple. So really, the book is this kind of crazy amalgam of a family's life, or, you know, in all its confusion and messiness that families are. And so when I was writing it, I was thinking, like, well, this is a really personal story. I think it'll find an audience, but probably not a big audience or a huge audience. And then the very first week it came out, it went right on the New York Times bestseller list. And I mean, what I like to think is part of why it succeeded is that I put zero energy into trying to figure out how to write a best-selling book. I just wrote the story that was in my heart, and this story I was kind of dying to get out of me, and I think that's really its secret to its success, is that it's just an authentic story that bubbled out of me.
It is so authentic, and I think, you know, I think we love stories, and I'm really curious, how did your wife feel about millions and millions of people reading about your life together?
Your sex life and miscarriages and...
Well, you know, We met at a newspaper. We're both journalists by profession, and we both realized that it's very hard to tell a good story if you can't be completely candid about it. And about halfway through the book, you know, I was seeing where the book was taking me, and it was almost like an out-of-body experience. The book was moving in these directions that were personal, that talking about our relationship, and, you know, Marley always right in the middle of whatever that situation was. And I said to her, you know, are you okay with this? And she thought about it a little bit, and she said, you know, if you can't write it without pulling punches, you should find a new topic.
Mm.
So she really gave me permission to just tell the story honestly and trusting me to do it respectfully. And then, you know, millions of people have read this book now, and she's comfortable with it. You know, it's really, for both of us, it's like a special little document that commemorates a really special part of our life, you know, when we were falling in love and starting out together and starting our family.
Yeah. You know, we do an hour every week talking about people's pets, and some people have said, why should a national show be devoting an hour of time to a program about pets? And we have some answers to that. I'm wondering about yours. Why do you think it's important to write about dogs?
Well, I think the response to my book is a pretty clear indication that pets are really important parts of our lives. And they have been in the whole history of humans. This goes back thousands of years. And there's a relationship there that's really special. I mean, that dogs have such empathy and intuition for the human emotional condition. And there's that sense of loyalty that goes in both directions. So, I mean, you know, people who have not experienced that bond will raise their eyebrows about writing about it, talking about it, or even about people who have lost a pet and are grieving after it. I mean, it's almost like you need permission to grieve for losing a pet, like it's almost like your car broke down or something, you know. But an animal is not an old car, you know. I mean, it's like losing a member of your family. So it's just a very important relationship, and you don't have to be, you know, what some people might call a crazy dog person to recognize that relationship.
I know Marley's been gone for quite a while now. Do you have a dog now?
I do. We made it about 9 months without another dog. And, you know, we really, after Marley, you know, it almost feels like it wouldn't feel right to bring another pet home so soon, because there's such a strong feeling there. But about 9 months later, we went out and we picked out another Labrador Retriever. We didn't learn our lesson. Actually, it's a wonderful breed, and we just love the Labs. They're just so joyous. And this Lab is very different from Marley. She's calm and very collected and sedate, kind of shy personality. Has that loyalty and all those great qualities, but none of the boisterousness that, you know, Marley did. I kind of joke about it. I say, great, her name's Gracie. Gracie, you're a great dog, you know, don't change, but also don't expect me to write a book about you, because you never do anything. I mean, my book about Gracie would just be about how she sleeps at my feet all the time.
Well, for the book about Marley, how has this book changed your life? For the better, I hope, for the worse?
Well, yes. I mean, pretty dramatically. In fact, I even put this in my acknowledgement page that Marley has finally paid me back for all the repairs I had to make to that house because of him. I mean, it's amazing. I think the biggest change for me is that the success of the book has allowed me to step out of my career as a daily journalist and really do what my first love is, and I can write books full-time now.
Oh, are you working on one now? Do we get to hear about it?
I actually just finished my next adult book. It's another memoir about growing up in the 60s and 70s in this Irish Catholic family in the Detroit area.
Oh, fantastic.
And it has my childhood dog as a character in it, but it's really, it's not a dog story. It's a growing up story. And I'm real proud of it, and that should hopefully will be coming out later this year.
As you think back on Marley and your life with Marley, any lasting lessons that Marley left in your household, even to this day?
Well, I'm a big believer that a dog is just about the greatest gift you can give a child. You know, after a good education, and you know, my kids. Right from birth, their earliest memories, there was this big, happy little Labrador in their midst. And I think he really taught them a lot about empathy and about responsibility and caring for others, and helped them to see that the world doesn't just revolve around me, the child. There's others in the mix. And So at a pretty early age, you know, Marley had, you know, it was such a character that they were looking out for him as little 3 and 4 year olds even, because they knew he could get in trouble or get hurt if he got outside or whatever off a leash. So I think that was one great lesson. And for something that comes so easily to dogs, you know, just the ability to love unconditionally and to just fit in and really have that loyalty without looking for anything back, is a quality that does not come so easily to humans. And I thought, you know, if we could all be a little more dog-like, we'd probably have better marriages, better work relationships, better relationships with our parents. And, you know, and it's just one of those things. Maybe we think too much and dogs don't. But, yeah, there's a simple beauty about the way an animal thinks and behaves.
John, it was a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been fun for me.
John Grogan is the author of Marley and Me, Life and Love with the World's Worst Dog. He joined us today from his home office in Philadelphia. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of John's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And it's time now for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and 4 lucky winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Marley and Me by John Grogan. And here's today's question. The Czechoslovakian wolf dog is a wolf dog hybrid that traces its origins to the 1950s. The hybrid breed was created by mating a wolf with what breed of dog? If you think you know the answer, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. To find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org, and we'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And if you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And here's a caller, by golly. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi there, this is Ed in Fairplay, Maryland.
Thanks for calling, Ed.
I was calling today about Blackjack the Border Collie. He's obsessive-compulsive, in particular, about chasing things like shadows, flashes of light on the wall, moving cars, and pretty much anything that reflects on the ceiling. Just by way of background, I work as an animal control officer for a county government.
Uh-huh.
And from time to time, I take at-risk foster dogs home, and Blackjack is one of these.
Aw, bless your heart.
My long-term goal is to put him to work for animal control. We run a lot of calls for at-large livestock and things like that, and I thought, what a great partner to have. It would be a border collie to help me round up cattle in the middle of the night when I'm out on call.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking to sort of unlearn this chasing behavior.
First of all, in terms of this obsessive reactivity to light, this is a big problem in especially border collies. I see it in other dogs as well. It truly becomes, Larry, it becomes like true obsessive compulsion and that the dog cannot not react. So there, if it's really extreme, I want you to talk to a veterinarian who is knowledgeable about using medication. Fluoxetine is one of the Prozac, basically, is one of the medications that has been used by some board-certified veterinary behaviorists. This is one of the reasons why I am totally opposed to laser lights, is you can teach animals, and I would never, ever have a border collie on a laser light because they generalize from following a laser light around on the floor. It's really funny, Larry, when you first see it.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, it's like this guy says, it's the car lights shining across the wall. It's the reflection in the stove door, and it becomes a big problem. So what I would, there's a lot I would do. One, I would start trying to teach a different response, and the fact that you have so much experience is going to be a wonderful benefit to Blackjack. I want you to start basically teaching your dog that a light is a cue to do something appropriate. So, you know, you say sit, that's a cue. You say lie down, that's a cue. I want the light to become a cue. So figure out what you want your dog to do. Go get a toy, turn around, look at me. You know your dog best. You know what you're most comfortable with. Find an incompatible behavior and then create situations with a light. You might want to buy a laser light and use it as a training device. Say you're going to teach him to get a toy. So you got this laser light, you do the light, then you say, go get your toy. And then you're going to drop out to go get your toy. So the laser light becomes the cue. And then you can start generalizing it to other situations where he sees a light.
Great idea.
Yeah, good. So, so try that. The fact that you know what you're doing and you got a border collie is very much on your side.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Ed, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-462-7413, and we do have another caller. Let's go there. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Mary Lynn, and I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Mary Lynn, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
I'm calling about my dog, Roger, who will not get in the car, which would not be such a problem if he didn't weigh 100 pounds and I had to pick him up every time to put him in the car.
Oh, dear. So, does he like it once he gets in the car?
Oh, yeah. He's completely calm. He goes to sleep. You know, the kids lay all over him, and he's like, oh, great. Lay on me some more.
Okay.
We found him as a stray when he was a puppy, and he grew about twice as big as the vet said he would, so I'm a little peeved about that. But we've tried putting treats, like, oh, right at the edge of the car and then, you know, a little bit further in. And if it gets too far in, he's like, eh, I didn't really want that anyway. So
okay.
The best we've gotten, he'll put his front 2 feet in the car, and I only have to lift his backside.
Does he like to play ball by any chance?
The ball is his favorite thing. Oh. He loves the ball.
Okay, there we go. We have our treatment plan. And I'll tell you why I say that, because the most success I've had with dogs who are okay once they get in a car but don't want to get in is to turn getting into a car as a game. So here, I just did this with a friend of mine. Her dog is on a leash watching my dog. My car is parked in the driveway with both doors open in the back, okay? So the right and the left side of the car is open. So there's like this tunnel.
Okay.
So she's holding her dog, who is fine once he gets in the car but doesn't want to get in and doesn't have anything physically wrong, by the way. Mm-hmm. That I would definitely want to make sure. You know, make sure there's nothing physically wrong with your dog.
Okay. I would say the vets checked him out because we thought, well, maybe nothing wrong with his hips. And
yeah, no, good for you. So good for you. So you've checked that out. So here's what you're going to do. The other dog does not get to play. He's not only being asked to get in the car, he's not allowed to get in the car. But he's going to watch while another dog plays fetch through your car. So you throw the ball literally through your car. In one door, out the other. The dog jumps in the car, goes through, gets the ball, runs around the car, brings it back to you. So you play fetch with this other dog.
Okay.
And the other one's watching like, oh, I want to play fetch. And then after you do that maybe 10 times, so your dog is like, I want to play, then you're going to go to the car and you're going to have him right be beside the car and you're going to toss the ball through and you're going to say, oh, no, honey, stay. You can't. No, stay. So you're really completely flipping. You're turning the tables on him. It's like, no, you can't get in the car. Until he's like, but I want to get the ball. I want to, want to, want to. And with maybe a third of the dogs, when you finally do throw it through the car, they will jump right in.
Oh.
The rest of them will be way better than they were before.
Okay.
And so, you know, you take that. Like, they'll put their front paws up, and they'll start to get up. And like, good boy, that's a good boy. And then maybe you give him the ball, you give him a treat, and then you quit there. And then the next session, you just work harder and harder at it.
Okay, so just progressively reward him as he goes a little bit further and further into the car.
And turn the tables on him. Basically, you can't get in the car, but look at how much fun that other dog is having. There's something called social facilitation, where one individual watches a member of their own species do something that makes it sort of catching.
Yeah,
you know, like
with their kids all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Good luck.
Well, excellent. I will try that. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Marilyn. Appreciate your call. You know, Patricia, all month long, we've been celebrating National Poetry Month with cowboy poet Baxter Black. And this week, Baxter pays tribute to his best, but not necessarily smartest dog, Bowler.
You were just a dog, but a good dog, right from the start. Your loyalty was never in question. And what you didn't know because I never took the time to teach you. When you were young, I was harder on you. I expected you to understand the basics, and you learned them. A bad dog was like a whip on your back. But when uncontrollable instinct got you in trouble, I didn't hold it against you. I doctored you up, changed your bed, and remembered that reason gets left behind in the heat of passion, be it skunks, gyps, or cloven hooves. You were patient with the young. Pups or kids, they pulled your hair and barked around you in circles and rode on your back. I never had to worry. They were safe with you. You suffered the indignities of veterinary examinations, injections, probings, and overnight incarcerations, refusing always to lift your leg under anyone's roof. You posed for pictures, rode on loads like an acrobat, and endured spring clippings, and yet never lost your sense of dignity. A fierce guardian of your territory, you did your best to protect us, and I knew better than to shout you down at 2 a.m. I always figured you were barking for a purpose. Old age was not unkind to you. Despite the hearing loss, cataracts, and stiff joints, you carried on. Sure, I had to help you get in the pickup, but you were part of the crew. I noticed you ate less, slept late, and turned gray, but you never lost your enthusiasm for being part of the outfit. People debate if dogs have a heaven. Well, I'm not sure that matters. What is heaven to a dog? Enough to eat, something to chase, shade in the summer, someone to scratch your ears and pay you a little attention now and then. All I know is that you added to our life. Companion, listener, guardian, and a connection to part of nature that we tend to overlook because we're too busy worrying about the minutiae of life. You reminded us to appreciate a sunny day, a bone to chew, and a kind word, and you'll be missed around here. You were just a dog, but you'll be in my heaven. Rest in peace, old friend.
Oh, boy. That was so nice. That was cowboy poet Baxter Black reading Just a Dog. You can learn more about Baxter Black and his poetry at our website, callingallpets.org. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0426P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.